You're listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. And now it's time for...
Listeners should be aware that the following program contains language and audio images which may be found disturbing and may not be suitable for your snotty-nosed little brat who probably cusses like a sailor behind your back anyway. Parental discretion is advised.
Greetings and welcome to another edition of Technology Bites. Thank you.
Really? That's it?
Yep.
All right. Is this one on? I can't tell. There it is. I just need to turn it on.
Jay's back.
Yay!
Yay.
Yeah, that's what you say now.
You can hear that Irish lilt in his voice.
I will say that it was, there were points when, you know, I was talking to people, and you know, you get the affectation going. My favorite thing that I came back with is it's not a butter.
Yeah, not a butter now.
Not a butter. Yeah, it's not a butter.
But not nutter butter.
Nutter butter, yeah.
Peanut butter.
Did you have Lucky Charms for breakfast every day?
I served by leprechauns, real live leprechauns, and I had Lucky Charms every day. We called it Guinness.
Irish Spring and all the
Irish Spring.
Did you have tipsy porridge where they put whiskey in the porridge?
No, I didn't have that.
That might be a good thing if you're driving that day. So,
well, I had my driving whiskey. it was a good trip. I've got many fond memories and a lot of great photos, so I could not be happier. So it sounded like y'all had fun.
We did.
Yeah.
Yeah, the thing that was really different is we started getting, like, how do I use my phone operating system questions.
I think that's going to be the wave of the future.
Yeah, well, we were talking about that. We said called that out like 5 or 6 years ago, and it actually happened last show. There's definitely a turn on the numbers.
There's a lot of iOS 7 and how do I and why do I and what do I and not a bother. So yeah, I listened to the intro to both shows to see how much crap I was going to get, and I was pretty pleased because the first one that I missed, Barrett was out with tooth problems. Was it
the
first
one? Yeah, that was the first one.
And
oral
then,
surgery. Yay.
And the second one, y'all went off on some other tangent.
Yeah, that's why we waited until about 25-30 minutes.
I don't care.
The chair is in the corner. Okay, we can. That was the code for dissing you.
Oh, okay.
Well, didn't listen that far.
Whatever. It was, I could hardly care. It was just too many leprechauns and whiskey and Guinness. All right. Well, welcome to the show. This is Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
And he's
Groovehouse.
And, Dwight is not with us tonight. He is
missing in action.
He's probably trapped in a small car with big tech somewhere.
He tweeted earlier about using his new headphones that he got.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I guess he got some, like, Sony, some kind of Sony wireless headphones or something.
Is that what somebody... packing is? I must test these headphones for 4 hours so they will work on the trip.
Well, so he's, yeah, that's what he's trying. He's trying out all of his tech. So, yeah, so he's not here tonight. I think he's avoiding me. I think he, you know, he didn't want to come down off the high of getting to do two shows where I wasn't here. You know, I understand. Yeah, I can't go face the studio until Jay's going to be back. I want to still enjoy this euphoria I was having, the Jay-free euphoria.
Having Pete down was pretty euphoric. That was fun.
Was it?
Yeah.
I'm glad that Pete was able to make it. Both shows, right? Pete.
Yeah, I came in for both. You know, the show's part was fun. The getting home at, you know, 1:30 or 2 in the morning was the tough part.
I'm just sorry it wasn't fundraiser.
Oh. Ouch.
That would have been really good shows to miss. All right.
But when you do see Jay, or when you do see Dwight Jay, when our first guest actually brought tchotchkes, he brought 3D printed Ars coasters.
Yeah, I saw the picture that Dwight had tweeted of that and was jealous that I didn't get one.
There is one for you. We got enough for everybody.
And yet I don't see it anywhere.
Well, I think he has it on him.
Oh, Dwight does? Or yeah. Ours does?
Now you have to take back all those things you tweeted about him.
I got mine from
Dwight.
Not
until you get it. Not until you get it.
Or you might get the broken one. And then last week...
It's got an E. It's got an E on the end of it.
R. It's got two R's.
Oh, no. Try again.
You were just over there. You should know that.
He doesn't know it from his elbow.
You were actually there for Talk Like a Pirate Day, right?
I was. In Ireland, every day is Talk Like a Pirate Day. It's not a bother. There were actually moments in Ireland where I knew that the person I was talking to was speaking English, but I did not understand what they were saying. Well, it's a great country. I recommend that you go there, everybody, as soon as possible. In fact, just leave now.
All 300 million of you Americans, head for Ireland.
And all 12 listeners.
Start the new potato famine.
Well, I'll tell you one of the weirdest things about Ireland is that it is next to impossible in some places, in a lot of places, in fact, to find potato-flavored potato chips.
Just plain?
Just plain. To them, plain is sour cream and onion. Huh. That's plain.
There's some cool, interesting flavors that you can get, like shrimp.
Prawn-flavored potato chips and beef-flavored potato, not barbecue potato chips, beef-flavored potato chips. But I figure they've just had enough of just potato-tasting potatoes. It's like, no, plain potatoes.
Did you ask for potato chips or did you go after crisps?
Well, I didn't ask. I went into the store and perused the shelves. That's the other thing when you're in a foreign country is if you go into a store, all the brands and all the products, they're not what you're used to seeing. So it's like you're in a movie set that didn't want to, you know, advertise for
not
somebody.
Not have to pay for the, yeah.
Yeah, or,
oh, they have Lay's? Because Lay's, I've been in several countries and it seems like...
They have some of the same Lay's stuff, yes. But for the most, I mean, even the one shop that actually had Pringles, no plain Pringles. Sour cream and onion Pringles, cheddar cheese Pringles, no regular Pringles.
Maybe they're still really upset about the potato famine thing, so they're willing to use potato in something, but they don't want it to taste like potato.
They just don't want to be reminded. Yeah. They just don't want to be reminded.
It's too bitter. They're doing for potato chips what they do for candy bars. Did you notice that? There's like 10 times as many brands of candy bars.
Yeah,
as there are here. Oh, there's all the ones here with different names.
Right.
And then more.
Yeah, and then there's also the whole issue of trying to find cookies. No chocolate chips, you know, just all kinds of weird. And they have all these weird names.
Biscuits.
Well, they have biscuits. There was one that was, I can't even remember what it was called, but it sounded like it was like a laxative or something. And
it was just don't eat that chocolate.
it was a cookie, but it had this weird, like, kind of technical name, like a nutritional bar. It wasn't like nutrition. I can't remember what
like
it was.
Like carabine wax.
No,
with cocoa.
It was like Vitality cookies or something like that. It was just weird. But anyway. So, and the Guinness, and it's true, the Guinness does taste better in Ireland. Mm-hmm. It's not pasteurized, I guess, is what it is. The one picture that I wanted that I didn't get, that I because it was on the other side of the river and it was driving by, but there was a tanker truck, but it was Guinness.
Oh, that's cool. They have their own tankers.
Yeah.
You know, I know the models of all of them, I guess you saw if you went through the museum.
Yeah. So, they have their entire ship fleet too, but this was like a tanker truck.
Oh, I thought you meant like a tanker ship.
No, this is a tanker. Oh, this is okay. Like one of those gasoline tanker trucks you see going down the highway.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
A big tube.
Yeah, just filled
with gasoline or milk. But this one it was just a big Guinness. Yeah. You know, crash into me. All right, so you can visit us online at geekradio.com or notabouter.com. if you like, or you can hang out on IRC, irc.cuckoo.com. In the channel Tech Bytes, or you can go to geekradio.com and click on our IRC link if you like, and join in the conversation. I'm going to do that right now. All right. And a little bit later on, we'll be taking calls in the show. So if you wanted to be on the air with us tonight, 713-526-5738. So I guess in the last 2 weeks, we weren't able to test the connection on the Skype. So we're going to get to see if that works or not tonight as we go to San Antonio. Live with Peter Hughes for the Technology Bytes Info Shot.
It's the Technology Bytes Info Shot. Technology news and commentary by Peter Hughes. Injected directly into your skull.
Well, from the Department of Irony, General Keith Alexander, the director of the National Security Agency, called on the public today to help defend his agency's powers as Congress mulls restrictions aimed at protecting the same public's privacy. Quote, "We need your help. We need to get these facts out," Alexander said during a cybersecurity summit at the National Press Club. "We need our nation to understand why we need these tools." He warned that if Congress hampers the NSA's ability to gather information, it would allow for terrorist attacks in the United States, similar to last week's massacre in a mall in Nairobi, Kenya. He also said that it would be a disaster of biblical proportions, human sacrifice, dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria. Oh, wait, no, that's the script of Ghostbusters. But he went that way. He said, quote, "If you take those surveillance powers away, think about the last week and what will happen in the future." He said, "You need us. You..." No, he didn't say that either. "If you think it's bad now, wait until you get some of those things that happened in Nairobi." He said the United States is fortunate to be able to have, quote, esoteric, unquote, discussions because the NSA and other agencies are effective in stopping terrorists. Following leaks by Edward Snowden this summer about the scope of the NSA's surveillance, numerous lawmakers, including Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Patrick Leahy, Democrat of Vermont, have moved to rein in the agency's power. The lawmakers have expressed particular outrage about the NSA's bulk collection of domestic phone data. Yeah, so Alexander emphasized that under the program, the NSA only collects data such as phone numbers, call times, and call durations, and does not listen in on any of the phone calls. I leave it to you to decide what you think about it. I do find it ironic that basically what he's asking is for people to run to him or their congressperson in fear to let them do whatever they want to quote, protect us from the bad guys like, you know, basically tied to every different bad event that's happened in the past week. Well, and now that you're feeling all comfortable, researchers from Russia-based Kaspersky Lab have uncovered a gang of hackers for hire who specialize in surgical strikes that quickly infiltrate suppliers to Western companies, steal highly sensitive data, and then vanish. This is a story from Ars Technica by Dan Gooden. He said Ice Fog is what the group of cyber mercenaries has been dubbed. Has 6 to 10 members who are able to infect both Windows and Mac computers with advanced malware that's extremely hard to detect, Kaspersky researchers revealed in a report published today. It's a tiny membership compared with other gangs engaged in advanced persistent threat, APT. It's so apparently so common or something that they abbreviate it. APT attacks that siphon gigabytes or even terabytes of sensitive data out of corporations, defense contractors, and government agencies. The so-called APT-1 group that hacked the New York Times 9 months ago, for instance, has as many as 100 members, which leaves plenty of tracks for security defenders to find. In the past 2 years, IceFog has compromised somewhere from 500 to 4,000 victims, according to Kostin Ryu, director of Kaspersky's Global Research and Analysis Team. The wide-ranging estimate is based on the data the researchers found on command and control servers that sent and received data from the infected machines. The IceFog backdoor is an interactive tool that attackers use in real time to rifle through infected computers, locate specific files, and then download them. The Mac version is known as MacFog. Easily decrypted data left behind on the servers showed specific targets that were penetrated and the names of the files that were obtained. It also showed the unique names of 400 Mac machines and 100 Windows PCs that came from 4,000 unique IP addresses. Ryu said that they believe the MacFog injections from last year were some kind of beta testing. Members, quote, wanted maybe to see if the malware was effective and if it could be used in the wild against their target. The Mac malware is fully functional and has the same features as the Windows malware. And the dog is working well tonight too. That way you know it's really from my house. Especially since it only happens when the news is going. In other news, Ericsson has this one. If you work at a big enterprise company, you know, and you're in your office in the middle of a building, and you get crummy cell reception, Ericsson has an interesting idea to the solution of weak mobile service in enterprises. They announced they're the world's largest cellular network vendor. They introduced a radio that can fit in the palm of your hand and hook up to a full-size base station via conventional LAN cables. The so-called radio dot system, due to ship late next year, will let carriers fill large and medium-sized buildings with strong voice and data signals while keeping their equipment and management costs low, according to Ericsson. While traditional cellular networks are built around large outdoor macro cells, most mobile use happens indoors. To accommodate all that voice and data demand, mobile operators long installed DAS, a distributed antenna systems throughout buildings, and more recently have used small indoor cells, you know, femto cells, which are miniature versions of the macro cells in the tower outside. Apparently that's expensive, any of those, and the small cells sharing the same spectrum with macro base stations have to turn down their power if they interfere with the bigger cell. Ericsson plans to solve this by putting the core components of a macro cell into a building and spreading the radio parts of the cell throughout the rooms as radio dots. And then the core unit, called the baseband, will be able to manage as many as 96 radio dots as one large cell. Then there's another platform that will sit between the dots and the baseband and house some other radio components that can be used for 3G and 4G, 3G WCDMA and 4G LTE. So hopefully next year that means there will be some good choices on enterprise cellular at different places. I know I've been at places that were so big that they essentially had, like, they made sure they had the equivalent of cell towers inside the buildings to cover more than one provider. But it looks like this is a cheaper, better way to do it. Apparently AT&T and Verizon are planning to test that system and try it out. So here's to better cell reception when you're at work. Makes those meetings go by so much better. And this one's interesting. You know, there's in the past there were people who talked about we've talked about running out of Moore's Law, and there was the whole oh gosh, and now I'm blanking on the name. There was that new type of computer that could do yes, no, you know, yes, no, and maybe, and they've built like six circuits, you know, six transistors of that. But here's something that actually is real that showed up within a year of creating the first carbon nanotube computer chip. Scientists have just built the first actual computer with a central processor centered entirely around carbon nanotubes, which means the future of electronics just got tinier, more efficient, and a whole lot faster. It was a group of engineers at Stanford. Apparently, the computer itself is relatively basic compared to what we're used to today. According to Suhasish Mitra, an electrical engineer at Stanford and project co-leader, its capabilities are comparable to an Intel 4004. That's Intel's first microprocessor released in 1971. So it's a little bit of a flashback. It can switch between basic tasks like counting and organizing numbers and send data back to an external memory, and that's pretty much it. The slowness is partially due to the fact that the computer wasn't exactly built under the best conditions. This is the first step. MIT Technology Review says, don't let that fool you, though. This is just the first step. Last year, IBM proved that carbon nanotube transistors can run about three times as fast as the traditional silicon variety, and we'd already managed to arrange over 10,000 carbon nanotubes onto a single chip. They just hadn't connected them in a functioning circuit. But now that we have, the future is looking awfully bright. Then Zach quote, theoretically, carbon nanotube computing would be an order of magnitude faster than what we've seen so far with any material, and carbon nanotubes naturally dissipate heat at an incredible rate, so you could hit blinding speeds without even breaking a sweat. So the speed limits that we have using silicon, which doesn't do so well with heat, would be effectively obliterated. Heat also equals waste of power, and of course you get the problem if it gets too hot, it basically melts the silicon. The future of breakneck computing doesn't come without its little speed bumps, though. One of the problems with nanotubes is they grow in a generally haphazard fashion, and some of them even come out with metallic properties, which would short-circuit whatever transistor you decided to use it in. In order to overcome these challenges, the researchers at Stanford had to use electricity to vaporize any metallic nanotubes that cropped up, and they formulated design algorithms that would be able to function regardless of any nanotube alignment problems. Now it's just a matter of scaling their lab-grown methods to an industrial level, which is easier said than done. The thing is, this does appear to put another nail in silicon's ever-looming coffin. And finally, yeah, you wondered if I was going to say anything about this one. There was no big rumor-mongering or any of that kind of stuff ahead of it, but Apple announced that they're updating the iMac lineup. Last year's all-new iMac, which was just last year, was an impressive performer and quite the looker. And the update to Haswell was expected at some point this year. Pixel density enthusiasts may be disappointed to learn that there wasn't a move to a higher density display, no Retina-esque, you know, higher res stuff for either the 21.5-inch or 27-inch. But the pricing hasn't changed either. So it's like just about $1,300 for the 21-inch, and the 27-inch model starts around $1,800. The big thing that's changed is they have Haswell processors. The base model has a quad-core i5, and the top-of-the-line 27-inch has what is likely to be the core i7, 3.5 gigahertz, and brings them up to the present generation of processors. The thing is, it doesn't take performance up that much. It's more efficiency, which is like what we've seen on the laptops. Big thing that could increase performance is an optional PCIe-based solid-state drive. While last year's solid-state drives were no slouches, the move to PCIe for flash storage opens up room for more performance. There should be up to a 50% performance improvement in storage speeds over both Fusion and all-flash options. There's actually a separate slot for the PCIe-based solid-state drive, and if you don't order one, it's still sitting there, although apparently it's very hard to get to. There's a decent upgrade on the graphics side. You can look that up if you're interested in it. Let's see, on the low end, Intel's own Iris Pro integrated graphics take the place of NVIDIA's GT640M, a good indicator that Intel's graphic efforts are making inroads on the lower spec machines. It may be sometime before we see an Intel GPU driving the 2560 by 1440 panel on the 27-inch, but for the basically high def, you know, 1920 by 1080, 21.5-inch model, it should be plenty. The other big things that changed, 802.11 AC Wi-Fi, which is if you've got a router that supports it, can get you some high-speed wireless. And that's a similar update to the other stuff. No cosmetic changes, although you can also continue to order the ThinMax with an integrated VESA mount. In other words, so that you can hang it on the wall or use stands to hold it up that are different than it comes with. The only other thing is options pricing changes a bit. The price of a 1 terabyte solid state drive option there's now a 1 terabyte solid state drive option, and that's $1,000 compared to the $1,300 that you used to pay for a 768 gig solid state drive. And these models are already available online or at your nearest Apple store. And that's the news.
Are you haunted? Are you being haunted? What was that noise?
That's probably a flute being practiced in the background.
A flute being murdered.
A beginner learning how to play.
Okay. It was the weirdest sounding thing. It sounded like a dog in severe pain.
I'm putting an end to this dog problem once and forever.
My guess on IRC was that it was a musical instrument from the movie Labyrinth. And Peter's actually dressed like David Bowie right now doing the news in a cod piece, like twirling
the crystal balls.
I guess shofar, but I also had my money on cod piece. So.
Cod piece.
It's always good to come back to this. This is awesome. It's not Irish, but it's still cool. All right, well... What now? Where's the static coming from? Did you turn something up or? I thought I heard that actually on the air too at one point. Are you not hearing it?
I hear it on my end. I know.
I think he's potting everything down to see if he can isolate it. Still hear it. It's just static.
It's just static. Ghost in the machine.
It's just somebody practicing the disruption patterns. It's weird. It's
7, 11, 12, 7, 1, 4.
We're in number station now. Yay. All right. Well, you can dial in at 713-526-5738. If you want to talk tech with Technology Bytes, we are your smartphone answering service or Windows XP Diagnostic Center or Windows 8.1 Gripe Line. 713-526-KPFT, and it's good to be back. We'd love to have your calls, and that noise is going to bother me. Now I'm just going to keep drawing attention to it.
All right, just a second.
All right,
so I'm going to make everything quiet for 1 second.
It didn't.
It went away. No, in my headphones, it went away.
It did not go away in mine.
Really?
So I'm wondering.
Headphones.
Is it my headphones? Do you hear it?
I can kind of hear a hum, but when I dropped everything, it went away.
All right. I think it might actually be me.
My headphones.
It's not your mic.
No, it's my headphones. Never mind. I got a short in my cable. I got a cable in my shorts.
Hey-o!
Nice. Hitching your get-along.
713-526-5738. I see a phone line ringing there. That's good. Groovehouse will have to get to work, which is always good. And we have plenty of open lines. Are you wearing that hat under your helmet, Barrett?
No.
No, okay.
No, that's a pretty cool look, though.
On the helmet would be even better.
No, I'm just tired of wearing a hat. No one, you're not taking any pictures, you know. I can put it back on if I offend you, though.
No, I'm glad to see you're kind of embracing the loss of hair.
Over the radio.
Groovehouse, however, is still rocking a full head of hair, so we need to talk to him.
I'm going to craft some hair.
I think we should
cuddle dye red.
I think we should harvest it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. If you're calling in and you're talking to Groovehouse, don't hang on to him too long. He's going to get you all queued up, and so you can be on the air.
Don't say anything that would stress out his hair.
Yeah, protect the hair. So, how was the Geek Gathering, by the way?
Dwight was, I think, the main person.
Really?
Said gathering.
Flick, yeah, well, you weren't at the gathering?
I was there. How long ago was this?
A few weeks ago. I was there. We had a lot of the hacker groups came out.
Really?
So, yeah, we had probably, you know, 8 or 10 people from there.
Oh, so, yeah.
Like, was, people came out.
I was there.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I remember now.
Oh, I totally remember.
No Rumble?
It's like all those people who were at Woodstock.
I had a couple of camo, Buffalo Bayou camo wits.
That's where the night went.
Is that what the kids are calling them now? So it was good?
Yeah, it was good. It,
you were there?
I was there.
Were Dave there?
It was a decent turnout.
Yeah, Katie Five was there. He brought out a lot of stuff, set stuff up. We had a monitor. We brought some stuff out.
Okay.
There was some new people.
Yeah?
That yeah, hadn't been there. I don't remember any nude people. Maybe that was later.
Someone did show up under the auspices of there being a food truck there, and then there wasn't.
Oh.
Yeah.
Too bad. So sad.
Dwight.
Great Scott showed up.
Great Scott.
Yeah, he played at DEF CON.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The DJ on one of the first big parties we went to before VT. Yeah, he was there.
Really?
He,
yeah. He's a local?
He played before.
Yeah, he's from
Houston.
Huh.
Yeah, I tweeted him last year after DEF CON because I saw him tweet and then I saw he was in Houston. So that was the first time I'd actually met him, even though we had kind of tweeted each other.
He was in Houston playing, or was he in Houston?
He lives in Houston.
Yeah. Houston. Okay.
Yeah, he and some people came out, which was pretty cool.
Awesome. Well, maybe we'll have another awesome one coming up, because we do have another one coming up, don't we? Yes.
Next Friday.
A week from Friday.
The weather should be beautiful for it if it stays true to current form.
If it doesn't suck. Well, I think we're only in a few days of really good low humidity, so we'll see.
It's the 1 week of not summer, and then it'll be over.
Yeah. All right. Groovehouse has queued up some phone calls, it looks like. If you want to be, if you want to get in the Groovehouse queue for Technology Bites, you can call 713-526-573. Did you hear us talking about your hair?
No, sorry.
No, that's good. That's good.
I'll go back and hear the archive.
Nothing to worry about. Calm.
Didn't say a word.
You seem to have lost the archives. Uh-oh.
don't stress the hair.
Don't stress the hair, guys.
That's what we're saying.
We're telling you not to stress your hair.
I'm about to stress because I don't know what was said. No, I'm joking.
Dibs on there if it falls out.
I'll donate it to you if you want me to.
Really? We were talking about harvesting it.
I need
harvest
scalp.
Some hair.
Will it dye red for Barrett?
Oh, I'm sure there's some genetic stuff you can do somewhere.
Really?
Somebody.
Some genetic stuff.
I don't know. Implant it, change some DNA. There you go.
It's Groovehouse for men.
You start growing coral on your head.
Yeah, he'll be a protected reef head.
Wow.
You gotta grow some red coral, Barrett?
Grow something.
I haven't gotten there yet, but when I start running out of options, we will we'll look into it.
Have to throw some tires down there and rebuild that reef.
Animal, vegetable, and mineral.
All right, Groovehouse. What?
Hydroponic system on my head or something. A bowl of water.
Don't mind the grow lights. We're just gonna attach these.
Here's some shades. Man.
He's a mobile hair farm. It's like a food truck where he's giving hair to people. I don't know where this
is. Hey, there's some food in my hair. I want a refund.
I think it's time for a haircut.
All right, Groovehouse.
Yes.
Who do we have up first?
Up first on the show with Jay back in the driver's seat, we are going to speak with Friesel.
Friesel, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello?
Hello, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Hey, guys.
Oh, yeah, hi.
I almost forgot my question listening to
news item.
Skin growing from heads and coral reef. I had a question about one of the news items, the news coming out of the NSA, and it's a question I've had for a while now, actually. I've always been curious, why is it that, you know, so they're storing metadata on our telephone calls, right, there, and they're claiming this with some level of maturity almost. Oh, no, look, we're only storing the numbers that you're calling, who calls you, the duration of the calls, and whatnot. And on top of that, it's not like we're just trolling through it looking for stuff. When we have, you know, we have some actionable intel, we can look at, you know, the record of calls retroactively and then dig through it. It's not like we're just always, right? This is what they claim, right?
Right.
And this is so that we can protect all of us from murdering hordes that are waiting outside our doors and terrorists and people.
Nobody likes a murdering horde.
Right. So now my question is that, you know, if they're claiming that it's okay to do this because A, they only look at it when they absolutely have to, and B, it's going to save us from the terrorists, then why aren't they making the case for, why don't they store the contents of the, they claim very clearly, like, we are not storing the contents of our calls as if that is some red zone and our metadata and our network and social networks and who we interact with and who our doctors are and what groups we interact with is not. I mean, why are they, why is it in our culture that it's okay to do one thing, to store all of these other things about our entire lives, but just not peep through the bathroom
door?
Well,
it's not okay. Well, who's saying it's okay aside from the NSA?
Well, I mean, they think that they have a case to make, and even the news and everything, I just don't know. Like, it seems like such a glaring, it sounds crazy. I mean,
they're making such a solid case.
They're arguing their heart out for being able to store all this data. Why doesn't anyone just ask them, like, okay, fantastic rationale. Doesn't all of that same apply to the actual contents of the calls? If don't you care about saving us from the terrorists? Why aren't you storing the contents of our calls, too? You don't care about us.
What were you going to say, Flicted?
Well, I was going to say that the group of people that think there's nothing wrong with that and probably would have the same argument if they said we're actually storing the contents of your calls. Some of them would drop off, I'm sure. But it's all those people who go, I don't care. I got nothing to hide.
Yeah, people if say you don't have nothing to hide, you don't have nothing to worry about.
Well, Bruce Schneier, who's like the Ivan, who was the Texas Ranger guy? Chuck Norris. He's like Chuck Norris of encryption.
Right.
Came out like just a few days ago, September 23rd. He said more or less that metadata equals surveillance. You know, pure and simple. The fact that they're looking at metadata, they're putting everyone in the U.S. under surveillance. And if we let it go on, we just have to get okay with the fact that we're living in a surveillance state. And it's not good. And honestly, they probably don't need to look at all the contents because they've got all they need to know from the metadata. And who says
that's
they're
correct.
Not looking at the contents? They just haven't been caught on it yet. You know, supposedly 9 months ago, they weren't looking at metadata either. You know?
Well, I mean,
I've been looking for one way to stick this to some NSA person on some talk show somewhere on TV and just ask, like, okay, why aren't you storing our voice? Does all that rationale not apply to our voice calls as well? What's the difference?
I think there's a sense, at least amongst the general public, that the content of the call is what's the most compromising or the most potentially damning. So I don't think people realize how much information is available through metadata.
Can be pulled from big data.
Right. Like, you know, location awareness, you know, frequency of phone calls, groups you're associating with, places you go and that sort of thing. Without actually having an ID tied to it. If you have your phone number's tied to it, they can tell they can get a lot of data from that. But I don't think the general public is fully aware. I mean, you've got people that go online and, I mean, there constantly are crimes that are solved because the criminals tweet what they've done. Like, you know, I was
talking. Right, right.
So people.
For me, the checksum still doesn't compute, even if that's the perception of the general public that, oh, you know, the contents of the calls it seems that may be the most damaging and the other metadata isn't. But contents of the calls would be the most useful thing.
I agree with what you're saying. And I believe if they could justify it without a large hue and cry from the public, they would say yes, and we're collecting all the actual voice part of the call. And like Barrett said, who's to say that they're not? They just haven't been caught on it. But if they came out and said they were doing that,
I don't think the voice is a lot.
Yeah, the voice is a lot. But if
now,
you
email,
yeah,
or chats, they could easily store that.
I still
that.
Think they're grabbing a lot
I
of that stuff.
I think they do.
I
think the perception thing is kind of the difference for the average person and the reason they're doing it, the reason they're approaching it the way they are, is there's a different perceptual difference between them, for instance, knowing your home address. They know, you know, everybody knows your address. You can look that up in the phone book, blah, 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 as compared to looking through your windows into the house while you're there. People, there's a pretty bright line for people, and I think that the average person, not somebody who's security conscious or who's paying attention to this stuff, knows immediately if the whole deal was they were keeping the entire contents of the calls or of whatever they're monitoring, that's too far, that's invasive to them, where they don't perceive it to be as much. They don't realize how much you can get from that.
Well, yeah,
the metadata.
That sounds scarier, but the issue is if you go back 20 or 30 years and look at some of like the wiretaps and like the information they gained from these, when they would actually do this kind of surveillance you're talking about, like opening up letters, listening to phone calls, they would try and reconstruct. You know, the first thing they try and do is reconstruct all the different relationships, figure out, you know, what social circles they're in, figure out what their patterns were. And that's what metadata is. It's like they almost cut out a step and made it cheaper, you know, by getting to arrive at all the same conclusions without having to listen to every single phone call.
Did we lose the call?
I think the NSA cut him off.
Yeah,
buffer overflow.
But they weren't listening to what he said. Inadvertently cut him off.
But to answer his question, I think, you know, it may be possible that they don't even actually need the actual content of the voice call. I mean, I suppose you could, because the only way that the content of the voice call would make much of a difference is if you could listen to it proactively rather than retroactively to predict, you know, that somebody's going to get on the phone and say, hey, I'm going to blow something up. And this is when I'm going to do it. You have to listen to it before the event actually happens. Otherwise, mm-hmm. It's just evidence that they did it. But all the metadata will also prove that.
I do think slowly kind of your average person's awareness is coming up just because the NSA chief, which is named Keith Alexander, about a week ago sent out a letter to all the family members of NSA agents and, you know, any kind of NSA employee or contractor, assuring them more or less that they weren't a horrible agency and that, hey, we're not doing really bad stuff. And keep your head up, to the point where I think that maybe a lot of NSA employees were getting, you know, a lot of hard questions asked of them by people that knew who they worked for. So that's actually online. If you just Google NSA Chief Defends Agency's Conduct, you can actually get a hold of the PDF that someone leaked.
Did Apple put out a new Apple TV?
No.
Okay. So all this stuff they're talking about in the new Apple TV, being able to set it up with your smartphone, is for the current Apple TV in the new operating system.
Oh, yeah, they did release an update to the Apple TV OS that adds some new features to it, but not actual new physical device.
Okay.
So the new iPhones are out there, right?
Yes.
Did they have any kind of cool events in Ireland where people, like, buzzed into that? Because don't they do, like, a world release day? It's not staggered, like, when it comes out here, it comes out in Europe?
I didn't detect anything that that indicated there was a big buzz about it.
It's not all countries.
Oh, okay.
So I don't know if Ireland's one of them.
I mean, it was in the news. I mean, it was definitely on the news, but I don't know if there was an actual Ireland release.
Uprising of Irish nerds.
There was an iPhone fanboy
nerds.
There's an iPhone.
Where all the iPhone 5Cs were all in shamrock green.
Everyone's wearing green turtlenecks.
Although I did find the news distressing and somewhat humorous in a hateful kind of way, that those people got robbed outside the AT&T store.
Yeah, here in Houston.
Waiting to buy a new iPhone.
No, I didn't hear about that.
That made the national
news. It was on the southwest side of town, which not horribly surprising that would happen there.
The Griggs Road store or something? I mean, that's...
I don't remember where it was.
No, it was Westheimer, and it was the Westheimer store, I thought.
Wow, Westheimer's should be on the up and up, you'd think.
Yeah, the AT&T store there. I don't know how far away it was, which part of Westheimer, but yeah.
But they were there at 5 or 6 in the morning or something. And I think there were only two people in line. And somebody came up and stopped their car and got out and robbed them and took their
phone and money. Yeah. It just doesn't pay to get up early, does it? Nope, sure doesn't. All right, so we lost our other call in the queue, it looks like. 713-526-5738. We've got about 15 minutes, 20 minutes left in the first half of the show tonight. And we've got time to take your call if you want to be on there. What?
I don't know if you saw my tweet, but I kind of lost interest in the 5S after it came out.
Oh, yeah, you're going to wait another year or two, maybe?
You know, so...
Well, you're still running a 4?
Running a 4S.
Right.
So, I mean, I understand that it's a jump in. Well, the screen gets longer, and the processor, of course, gets better.
Right.
Camera got better, whatever. But the thing is, nothing about it really excites me enough to make me feel like it's worth $750.
No, I think that based on what I know about the way you use your phone, I don't know that the enhanced camera would be much of a benefit.
Yeah, so I mean, the only thing I really thought would be good for me is the increased processor speed, but the thing is mine's not running sluggishly now, so I really don't know that it's worth it. So I may wait a year or maybe even 2 years. But I'm thinking in the interim, if Google releases the Nexus 5 at the same like super low price that they released the Nexus 4s, I might buy a Nexus 5. Not to run it with Android, but to sideload Ubuntu for Android, or to actually replace Android with Ubuntu's OneTouch, their mobile OS that's coming out. Because in both cases, the Ubuntu system, you can actually take the phone, and if you've got a Cradle that has HDMI and USB out, you can actually plug it in and get the Ubuntu mobile desktop on a, like, it's basically a computer that's the size of a phone. Because you've got a quad-core processor. You've got a functional computer from 5 or 6 years ago that's that size in your pocket. So that seems really cool.
Yeah, it does. It kind of makes me want to consider it because it sounds like you could tinker with it and it's interesting again.
I also was thinking, like, maybe I'll get one of the Firefox, because Firefox released a mobile OS and the first hardware just started rolling out.
The DevPhones came out last week, before.
Yeah, the Zio or whoever, it's French, Spanish. I don't remember where they're from. They're not from the U.S. And they were selling them on their eBay store for like $99, but they're all gone. But the thing is, the specs on it's really fairly low. Like it's really not a very high end smartphone.
It's not a flagship phone.
It's a functional smartphone, but it's not very fast. But anyway, but it was I think it was $80 actually. But for that price, it's like it's almost worth it just to have it to play with it. But anyway, they sold out. So, but there's other manufacturers that are coming out with other hardware running the Firefox OS, but that was the first one to release.
I'm just waiting for the equivalent of VirtualBox for your phone so that then you can just have all these different OSs on your one phone.
I was thinking about that too. I was trying to solve a problem for somebody with the new iOS 7 and I realized that I stupidly upgraded both my iOS devices. I should have kept one of them at iOS 6 and one at iOS 7. And I was thinking it would be really awesome if I could just fire up a virtual iOS 6.
Can you do that in the SDK, in the iPhone SDK? Does it run a full
I don't know.
iOS version?
I bet it does.
I think so. I bet you can probably do older versions.
So you might be able to get an older version of the iPhone SDK and actually use it on your computer.
Do you have to sign up for the $100 dev developer to get that?
You do, although somehow I got a dev account at some point. I think I have one.
Okay. Well, I just realized that, you know, it would be awesome to be able to run the iOS, like what Pete was saying, it would be cool to have multiple operating systems, like Parallels for iPhone,
well, the,
Parallels
the,
for mobile.
The Ubuntu for Android, which is in beta right now, and I think it's only working on basically the Nexus line. I think that's about it, Nexus 4, 7, and 10s. But it actually sideloads, so Android's still running, but Ubuntu's running in the cores that Android's not running in.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
I haven't played with it. I just was reading stuff about it.
But you would if it was cheap like that.
So if the Nexus 5 comes out and it's priced low like the 4 was, the thing is nobody's really sure yet because they haven't actually released details about the 5. So they don't know how much it's going to sell for because it seemed like Google was really trying to show off, like, no, guys, this is a good phone running Android with the 4, and they priced it to sell. So they're not sure if Google's going to do the same thing with 5 or if they're going to have already proven their point and they're going to put it back to a reasonable price.
713-526-5738. If you want to be on the air with Technology Bites, we have time to take your calls, a few calls before we break for the top of the hour. And if we don't get to you in that period of time, we can always bring you on after. Do you have a Barrett time tonight?
Yes.
Wow.
I did it last night. I'm realizing that I'm not getting out of work.
You had to make sure you had one for Jay's triumphant return.
Mm-hmm.
Is it triumphant?
It's slightly triumphant. We'll see. It's actually kind of bleak and matrixy. Sorry.
I was talking about my return, but
well, no, still. But, my answer stays. But,
I regret nothing. Look at he's just he's releasing endorphins from his being so amused that it's helping with his leg pain. All right, you'll see a call coming in, and it looks like more people want to talk about the NSA, so feel free to call in and talk about your favorite national security agency. 713-526-5738 if you want to be on the air. Groovehouse, I see you have a call for us.
Yes.
All right, let's have that call.
All right, up next on the show, we are going to speak with Andy.
Andy, you're on the air with Technology Bytes.
Hey, guys, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
Doing wonderful. Listen, on the NSA spying, I was under the impression that in addition to them picking up the metadata, they were also storing the contents of all the calls also. Because weren't they saying that they're storing it and they could go back at a later time and look at, let's say they find out something going on with a call, they can go back and look at the content of the calls at a future date. I thought that's what they were doing also. Is that wrong?
I'm not.
I don't remember hearing that about phone calls.
Not yet. I know that the new facility they're building is supposed to be able to do that, and I also heard that they had active things they were doing, but they kind of had to make a special request
to
like do that.
Secret warrants.
They had to do the FISA court approval. But again, this is all, you know, they're 9 months ago they
weren't
doing this.
It's all gray anyway.
So, we don't know that they're not doing it.
I don't think
that they said that they are doing it, but the stuff, whatever it is that they are collecting, that supposedly goes into a vault of some kind, and then you have to
a lockbox,
and you have to get a warrant and all that stuff, proper procedure, and then be able to go get the data.
Okay,
which Snowden claimed he didn't have to do.
If they're storing it in a lockbox, if they're storing it on a server somewhere, if they get a warrant, doesn't that per se mean that they're actually storing the contents of the calls
and
they can go back at a later date to go and search it?
What ProPublica said about it is that there have been several reports that the NSA records the audio contents of some phone calls, and one of the leaked documents confirms this. It reportedly happens on, quote, a much smaller scale, unquote, than the other programs after analysts select specific people as targets.
Maybe somebody that's red flagged, but they don't actually have a warrant for, so they're not supposedly not listening to it until they... But they're recording it for people that are red flagged.
They're saying there's between 500,000 to a million people that are flagged for that. So says Bruce Schneier and the couple of leaks that he's talked to. So
right, we don't know who's telling the truth.
I'm assuming NSA is not telling the truth.
some of the stuff that they have been leaked and that some people have reported on is that, and we talked about this last week, I think, also, was that the NSA, there were some documents from Snowden's release that the NSA possibly had ways to hack standard encryption that's used across the stuff, but also
we'll
that they possibly have backdoors and some of the SSL hardware, encryption hardware that people are using, and also that they've gone to companies and done gag orders to them to make them give them their private keys so that they can actually decrypt traffic, encrypted traffic as it's going like through the backbone routers.
Yeah.
That's the thing. They've actually been able to go in and actually erode the random number generators to the point where when you start to do the encryption stuff, it degrades the encryption, and they can actually ramp some of these chips back up to where it puts in enough entropy for it to pass certain encryption tests. But when they need to, they can degrade it down to the point where it's working. Now, a lot of the cryptographers out there have said that they still believe in the mathematics behind cryptography. That still works, but the problems are with the implementations. That's where you're going to have the issues.
Well, one of the things that I think Snowden said early on when this first leaked was that he had the ability to listen to phone calls through the job he was doing with the NSA.
And from anybody,
And that he did that, and it was also, I believe, said or implied that other employees of NSA or of the government were able to do it and were doing it for entertainment or amusement.
Oh, I'm sure that stuff is going to get abused. I mean, that's a big thing. They can say whatever they want to. They can have all these safeguards in here, but the idea of having a secret anything, it's going to evade having that watchdog over it. You know, you can't really set it up.
At the end of the day, they're the government version of Enron.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, even if they were, like, not recording the phone calls, you don't know what phone calls have been listened into in real time or surreptitiously recorded by contractors for the government. And that's been one of my points, is that if any of the data that they have, whether it's all of it or some of it, that data is then accessible by anybody who has access to those systems. So even if the official policy is that we don't listen to these phone calls until we have a warrant, doesn't mean
officially they don't.
Yeah, officially we don't. But we cannot guarantee that some rogue operative is going to listen into your phone sex.
Exactly.
I mean, Snowden came away with all those files, but who knows how many people got those files and did nothing with it. Other than, you know, take it home and look at it or do what have you. So,
yeah. I mean, my impression, from what I've been hearing coming out, is basically all encryption is, backdoored at this point. And I'm assuming most of the OSs are backdoored. And the major software programs
A lot of people have actually cooperated with them, but this is really cool. Linus Torvalds was at, I forget which conference. It was a large Linux conference about 2 weeks ago, and one of the questions came from the audience: has the NSA approached you to backdoor Linux? And he said no while shaking his head yes. Which is awesome, because I don't think he's going to get arrested, but everyone kind of knows now. So, which is also good, because you know that if you're compiling from source on Linux, because it's open source, enough people look at it, that's probably something good. But if you go get Red Hat Enterprise Linux and just get the binaries, you're at risk, you know, unless you actually get the source.
Well, I've also heard that compiling from source is no longer I read an article a couple weeks ago I forget who it was. Somebody giving a talk on compiling.
Well, you can obfuscate
saying that
code.
Even the compiler can be compromised, and
there's a double-blind compiler thing, but someone else put a paper out there on how to attack against that. There's always going to be, you know, red versus, like, one side versus the other side, good versus bad, and it's always going to be a battle going back and forth. But, yeah, it's really hard to compile tough code, because unless you write the compiler, unless you write everything from the ground up, you really don't know.
Yeah, but then again, look who they had working. I mean, if you're working for the NSA, I assume that you're going to be pretty damn good at what you're doing.
Yeah.
So, you know. So the question is, how do you go and roll all this stuff back? I mean, if there's backdoors in the hardware and the software, and if all electronic, you know, everything electronic is surveilled, from phone calls to texts to anything you do in the net, how do you go and roll this stuff back?
We got to make the government change. We got to get upset, and we got to go here in just a minute.
Yeah, we got to break from the top of the hour. That's a good question.
Hey,
I don't think there's an easy answer for that.
Yeah. Hey, thanks a lot, guys. Have a good one, and thank you so much.
All right, appreciate your call. Have a good night.
Night, y'all.
Bye. You know, like I said, if Obama was to come out with a big red erase button and push it in front on the National Mall, would people believe that it was all gone? I don't think it's gone. It's like the Streisand effect.
It just go darker.
Yeah. Hmm. All right. Well, we got to take a short break here and do some station business. So we're going to take that short break and do that station business, and we'll be right back in a few minutes. You are listening to Technology Bytes. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Plicted.
I'm Barrett.
And he's
Groovehouse, the hair farmer.
Jumpstart your weekend and get your groove on with the region's finest musicians at Discovery Green during the Fall Thursday Concert Series. Enjoy free concerts showcasing dynamic entertainers from Texas and the Gulf Coast every Thursday night from September 19th to October 17th. Thursday concerts at Discovery Green are co-sponsored by 90.1 KPFT FM. Legendary Texas musician Ray Wiley Hubbard hits the park for a night of gritty country and bluesy rock and roll on September 26th. Shiny Ribs, featuring Kevin Russell from the Gourds, opens the show. This concert is a St. Arnold recycling night, so bring your empty 6, 12, and 24-pack containers to earn double St. Arnold reward points. Concerts begin at 6:30 p.m. each week. Everyone is welcome. Most street parking is free starting at 6 p.m. Bring your picnics, blankets, and lawn chairs, but please leave your glass containers and alcohol at home. Please visit discoverygreen.com for more information.
Do you or someone you know own a local dining establishment? KPFT has a pledge drive coming up. And each drive, restaurants in the area feed our phone volunteers who give of their time to help KPFT reach its goals. Donations of food by these establishments are tax deductible and help community radio in the process. We also thank your establishment on air. Call 713-526-4000 for more information on how Houston eateries can lend a helping hand to KPFT. Ideal locations will be close to downtown Houston and be able to provide meals for 12 hungry volunteers. Again, that's 713-526-4000 for more information. This is 90.1 Pacifica Radio, kpft.org, twitter.com/kpft, facebook.com/kpfthouston.
You're listening to 90.1 FM, KPFT Houston.
Hey, Barrett, what's happening?
I don't know.
Well, room around town.
We interrupt this skit to bring you...
Yeah. That means it's time for...
Baritone!
Yeah. Anyway. Take it away, Barrett.
All right. So, some time has passed since the last Barrett time, but not all that much, really, assuming you keep time by internet standards. Now, I know that many people claim that internet time actually moves at a much faster pace than time in real life, but I'm here to tell you that it's all an illusion. There is no spoon. At least there's no ntb.spoon.com. Truth is that we've all been trapped in a time, we've all been trapped in time since a singular event changed the net forever. As the doctor would say, this event is a fixed point in time, and as much as everyone would like to change it, it can never be undone. Does anyone in the studio want to take a guess as to the current date on the internet?
The current date.
I'll give you a hint. It's a month.
It's not a star date.
It's a month.
Date is a month?
Yeah, we've been stuck in a month for quite some time.
November.
No. We're still in it. It never ends. What month is it now? September.
September.
Yeah, we're always going to be stuck in September. September 1993, a.k.a. the September that never ended, or as it's properly known, Eternal September. Okay, so what was the event that changed the internet forever? Anyone know? Okay, we'll get to that.
YouTube.
Yeah. We'll get to that, but first we need to do a bit of reminiscing about the early days of the internet as we run our fingers through our gray beards. If you don't have one of your own, it's okay. You can use a friend's or family member's, provided you get the permission first. You're cool with this, right, Jay?
Yeah, whatever.
Borrow the beard. Okay.
Al Gore.
Here we go. Back before what we currently call social media, before blogs, before Twitter, before Friendster and PHP Nuke, there was Usenet. Built in 1980, full decade before the World Wide Web, Usenet allowed users to both read and post messages to one or more virtual areas of interest. First, Usenet had a small user base with primarily academic background. There was kind of a sense of community and a set way of doing things. Of course, there was always an influx of new blood, but the new Usenet users came in predictable waves as college freshmen were given their first internet access, and with it, their first taste of Usenet. Okay. Of course, this happened every September, and by the 1st of October, these new netizens had been properly educated in the etiquette of the net, aka netiquette. Now, those that didn't fall in line often lost interest as school got underway and the novelty of flame wars and the fine art of frequently asking the same questions wore off. So Eric S. Raymond put it in the jargon file. It was one of the seasonal rhythms of Usenet. The annual September influx of clueless newbies who, lacking any sense of netiquette, made a general nuisance of themselves.
AOL.
Yeah, and there you go. All of this changed in 1993 when America Online granted its tens of thousands of users access to Usenet. So,
ooh,
of course,
I remember that.
Yeah,
yes.
It did. You got that. Of course, this number quickly grew into the millions as the online service's popularity ballooned. And instead of the annual manageable influx of new users, the floodgates have been opened to the masses who are poorly educated in internet customs, netiquette, or the ins and outs of not using all caps in everyday posts.
If you want a visual of what it looked like when AOL came to Usenet, imagine the caddy. The caddies showing up at the swimming pool in Caddy Shack.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the intake of new users was on such a grand scale, it just overwhelmed the existing culture. From the point of view of the pre-1993 users, the influx of newbies and Me Too posts in September of 93 never ended. Ooh. So the term was introduced by Dave Fisher in January 26th, 1994, in his post to Alt Folklore.computers, where he wrote, "It's moot now. September 1993 will go down in net.history as the September that never ended." So while NIST and a number of other timekeeping organizations have gotten internet time all wrong, one Usenet server, formerly known as mozzarella.org, now calls itself Eternal September and gives the date as a running tally of days passed since September of 93. So I guess you can have your beard back now, Jay. Darn cross-posting kids. Got off my health that long.
I guess the residual grumpiness from the beard. It turned out to be a candy bar.
Cross-posting was annoying.
Yeah, so if you'd like to brush up on your netiquette, you don't have to look any further than RFC 1855. And although it was written in October of 1995, probably in response to the effects of the Eternal September, it still contains a wealth of relevant information. A couple of the highlights: don't send large amounts of unsolicited information to people. Well, that'd kill spam right there. And don't blame the system administrator for the behavior of the system users. So it's actually pretty good. It's 15, 20 years old, but everything still applies today. So that's it. Actually, that's not it for the September of 93, but that's that for Barrett time.
I remember I was working at Neosoft when AOL, I think when AOL opened up the floodgates. And I mean, we were giving access to Usenet to dial-up users. I mean, it wasn't just, I mean, AOL certainly was a floodgate. But commercial, consumer level dial-up access.
But people still had to configure WinSock, get an ISP, go through you guys, and then get a news client reader and do this stuff. AOL made it to where click, click,
I know.
Boom, I'm polluting the news groups.
Usenet was also, I mean, you had to search it out back then.
Uh-huh.
And it was, I will say, Usenet, well, it was a whole bunch of mostly very odd, quirky culture, subcultures. Like, all the groups had certain, common people that were well-known in those groups, and everybody knew who they were, and they were, minor celebrities in this, one group of people. And they all had, their own folklore for that, that group and their own history. A lot of them had history files. They had facts for, here's some people you should know, because I was actually one of those people in one of those groups, and so there was a fact that, listed me and said, this is a person, you need to know who this is, this is what he does, so don't freak out, kind of thing.
There'll be a quiz on Tuesday.
So, yeah, it was a very odd culture, because it was a bunch of, basically pretty intelligent people that were into computers, which tends to be some esoteric people.
Well, the other thing, I think, when that mass flood of consumers came on to what was pretty much virgin, really literally virgin territory, in the computer culture of the time before everybody flooded on, all the people who used computers and used the internet and used whatever networking services understood that this was a thing that you had to finesse. You had to know how it worked to make it work. And it was not a surprise when it didn't work. It was like, okay, well, here we go. We've got to fight through this problem to get everything back online. When everybody flooded onto the internet, there was a sense that this was a finished product, mm-hmm. and that it should just work. Mm-hmm. And if it didn't, then it was up to, AOL, companies like AOL probably got smart with their, that was some of the first script reading tech support to come around, because they weren't going to dig in and help people do this stuff. But mom and pop ISPs like Neosoft and NSYNC and like that, tech support, we had real tech support people there really helping people to do it. I was configuring WinSock for people. I was configuring NNTP clients for people. And I was having to go around and look in the news servers to figure out why we didn't have the, number 3 of 72 for this binary upload that they were looking for. Why didn't we get the full feed? And
What group are you? I'm in alt.binaries. Bye.
Alt.bye-bye. No, when I was working at Neosoft, we had users that they did not care that we knew that they were downloading porn.
You're not updating against alt.fetish.ghost often enough?
Did you pull all the alt groups?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, at one time we had it all, but it was not super reliable. We were pulling all that stuff down, and people were just slurping it down on dial-up.
Well, the support back then, a friend of the show, Matt Solnick, I remember, couldn't get online, 2 in the morning. He was a little kid. He called the support. He had Linux ISP, and the guy was like, he called at 2 in the morning. He's like, hey, man, this is my home phone. Call back at, 9 a.m. So it was, you would actually get real engineers, real people, yeah. It's not really like that anymore.
No. So, it's... Unfortunately, a lot, things like iPhones and tablets and all the current GUIs and stuff do make it a lot easier. I mean, getting online is, we haven't had a person having trouble getting online call in a long time.
Well, I think it's seamless to the point where people don't even think about it. I'm sure, kids, as much as they can use tablets and phones and things like that, I don't think they probably have the first clue about, how these things actually communicate. That's my guess. That also could be my age kicking in, but that's my suspicion.
Well, I think we have a generation growing up that doesn't care.
Yeah. Well, it's there. Yeah, it's like how water. I don't care how the water gets there necessarily. Not everyone's plumbers. It's just there.
When I was in Usenet, which I started using Usenet in maybe 90 or 91, maybe not early 91 or something. And for years, there was always this certain group of people. Like this person I was friends with at the time who had her own alt group because she was a phenomenon in Usenet. Her and a bunch of other people that she ran with, which were also Usenet famous people, always had this imminent death of the net that they always talked about. Like it was like they would always trademark, imminent death of the net. This something would happen. They're like, this is the imminent death of the net, and they kind of joked about it, but at the same time it was like, it's going to happen. This is it. This happened. It's the imminent death of net. And I'm sure when AOL, because I remember people passed around the first time somebody posted from an AOL.com account into Usenet.
I remember.
It went all over Usenet.
I remember that. It's like, they're here.
Yeah.
It was a sense of...
And that
of
was like imminent death of the net.
The unwashed masses are at the gate. They're coming through. We cannot stop we cannot stem the tide. Yeah. I remember that really well. It was AOL people, that was just a whole different breed of people coming onto the net. And there's still a lot of AOL users out there, and people even that have regular dial-up accounts or have regular broadband accounts still using the
AOL.
They want
to keep their email address, a lot of those people.
At some point, it'll get ironic and cool, but we're not there yet.
You sure?
I
could almost want an AOL address now. Almost. Actually, what's funny is when I had my first encounter with someone who has an AOL address that I respected, because it was Tony Levin from King Crimson and Peter Gabriel and all that. He was looking for some camera advice, and a friend of mine knows Tony Levin, so he was asking about Sony, and my friend knows I shoot Sony, so he told Tony Levin to email me and ask me about, and he asked me if it was okay, and I said, well, of course. And so I get this email from Tony Levin, and his email address is at AOL.com. And the guy is, technically his music is technically proficient. He uses technology to make music. The guy is not stupid. He's not, but he has an AOL account. It just makes me.
That was bad. I would discount stuff just if it had the AOL thing on there. It's like, okay, ignore.
I would disregard emails, requests for help if they came from AOL. But I still every now and then get fun from AOL. I still see Prodigy floating around.
What about
Prodigy's cool?
CopyServe?
Yeah, Genie was one of the big ones back then. Those are cool. I don't know why. I guess just because AOL just had too many people that didn't know. Because
they gave away 4 billion free CDs with 500 hours.
Well, AOL was one of the first bloatware pieces of software you encountered on a computer. AOL was pre-installed.
Yeah. Oh yeah, they got a lot of companies to preload that on.
A lot of companies to preload
computers.
Their stuff. That stuff on there. I remember when AOL converted to TCP/IP as their connection method. Ah, yes. Well, get off my lawn. And Groovehouse had noted on a message on there to go back to an earlier conversation. Yes, it was called a digestive, the cookie, what the name of it was.
That was probably pretty safe to eat then. Without having to make sure you know where all the road stops are.
As
it depends on how you parse it.
A constipative.
Because it's digest if. Then,
no, it's IVE. It's IVE. He spelled it wrong.
Yeah, he wrote digestive.
Right. It's digestive.
Digest was, if
it,
then else.
No, the fact that the cookie said it was digestive. It's almost as if it was doing the digesting. It's like, oh, this is designed to, like, clean you out or something. This is like, you know, I don't. It just did not sound.
In America, it's
so
his brain is colon blow.
That's one of the funnier language moments was when we were in Galway, and we decided instead of driving to the ferry to go to Inishmore, we were just going to go on the bus. So we went and talked to the tour group and said, you know, and he used the term and says, okay, so you buy your ticket and you go around and you stand over here and you wait for the special bus. And Cynthia says, in America, that has a different meaning. So when you're telling Americans that they're going to ride the special bus, and they explained it to him, and he goes, oh.
That's not what I meant. Just in that short bus over there.
713-526-5738. If you want to be on the air with us here on Technology Bites, we only had two calls throughout the whole show, and they've both been about the NSA. So if you want to continue that conversation, you're welcome to. We can speculate on just how pervasive your loss of privacy actually is, or we could talk about your hard drive problems or whatever. 713-526-KPFT. If you want to be on the air, all the open lines are open. And we can have your calls, and it's still September. So where's the website for that? Is it eternalseptember.com or forever?
Eternal September, and I believe you need a. Let me go find it. I got through it via a news reader. It may not have a web interface.
Eternals-September.org.
Oh, it's still out there, I guess. Is that the same one?
Free access to the news server, privacy hierarchies,
that's
and groups. 713-526-573. Is there anything going on? Like, I know a lot of the TV shows are coming back. Is the next season of Battlestar Galactica started yet or something?
Is there going to be one?
No, I'm kidding. rumors. 713-526-573. And if you want to be on the air, there's a call coming in. That'll put Groovehouse to work. All right, so I'm getting all caught up on my TV shows, too. A lot of shows restarted while I was away. Breaking Bad, Sons of Anarchy. Who watches Dexter? Anybody watch Dexter?
I haven't seen this season, and I very rarely look at spoilers, but I happen to be looking down at my phone when one of your little things popped up, and I assume it contained spoiler stuff. Something about the code, and I stopped reading.
Yeah,
backed away from it quickly.
I didn't actually spoil it, but okay. It's... If you could make sense out of that tweet to spoil it for you, but I will tell you this, the final series finale, I mean, the series is over.
Fulfilling or unfulfilling?
So disappointing. It was like Lost.
But
where Lost, you were confused, and at least you thought maybe you might have missed something. This one, you totally knew that you were being ripped off. It was unfortunate. All right, I see Groovehouse has some calls in the queue, so... But if you haven't seen the series finale of Dexter yet, you might want to spare yourself that agony. All right, Groovehouse, who do we have?
All right, up next on the second half of the show, we are going to start it off with Winston.
Winston, you're on the air.
Yeah. Okay, hi. I had a question about, I bought a Passport external hard drive, Western Digital.
Yeah.
And it worked pretty well for a while, and then it went bad, and so I started to do Googling, and it seemed like there's an awful lot of discussion about how to try and recover or what to do when your passport drive goes bad. I was just wondering if there's bad experience overall with the external hard drives. Are they not very reliable, or what?
Well, like any technology, you know, they can go bad. I mean, the external hard drives are simply a hard drive plugged into a case that has an electronic interface that allows that drive to communicate with your computer over USB or, in some cases, FireWire and other connections. So sometimes the circuitry in that box will go bad. And but the hard drive itself is still intact. So if you take the hard drive out of the box and find a new connector to connect it to USB to your computer, you might be able to recover the data. What is the problem that you're seeing?
Well, it just right now I bought another passport to try and back it up. It would work for a while, and then it would stop working. Or sometimes when I tried to access a certain directory on the drive, it would just lock up and stay like that.
Did you try taking it to another computer?
Yeah. Yes, I did.
Did the same thing?
Yeah, same thing.
Well, I mean, I have a passport, and I'm not super happy with it, but, I mean, it's just I bought it secondhand or, you know, refurb or whatever, but it's been kind of flaky for me. The question is, you know, when it comes to hard drives, once any kind of hard drive starts acting bad, I tend to lose faith in it. Even if it starts working okay again, it's like I don't trust my data. If I'm using it for long-term data storage, if I'm using it for something just for occasional data storage to move data back and forth between systems or something, I might keep using it. But if I'm using it for backups and stuff where I have to rely on the data that's on there, once the drive is misbehaved, I don't want to use it again. So if this thing is not working right, then I would probably abandon it. But there are some ways to recover your data. There might be some ways to recover your data before you do that.
Yeah.
And one of them is to actually open up the enclosure and take the hard drive out of the enclosure and then connect it to a new enclosure or some kind of adapter cable that would allow you to plug it into your USB port and copy the files off of it.
Yeah.
That's assuming that it's just the electronics that connect the drive to the computer that are bad. Now, if the drive itself is bad, then that's not going
to
really help.
Sounds like bad sectors to me if he's having issues with certain files in certain
that's
directories.
What it sounds
yeah,
like.
So I would get the data off there as quick as you can.
Yeah, well, I would have thought that with the ratings for these drives, you know, the number of hours that they're supposed to work before they fail, I would have thought they'd be very reliable.
Well, here's the deal, though, with the external drives where you still have mechanical parts, is the MT, like the mean time before fail numbers, those are usually designed for, like, desktop machines where the machine's not going anywhere. If, you know, the desktop machine gets kicked, the case and, you know, just the mass of the machine is going to absolve, it is going to absorb most of the impact. Now that you have, you know, these platters that have mechanical pieces, you know, with readers that can hit the platters and all kinds of stuff can go wrong, and you've got a smaller package and it feels every bump, every jiggle, you know, you're going to have failures happening a lot sooner as far as mechanical stuff goes, just by the nature of jostling the drives around so much.
I will say that, you know, for myself, that I, you know, I've never bought an external hard drive. I have bought, but I no longer buy external hard drives that are single drives.
Uh-huh.
I only buy RAID setups that mirror it onto two drives.
Okay.
So that I don't have, so I run less of a risk of losing the data. I cannot rely, and in my experience, it's ridiculous to rely on a single copy of your data.
Yeah.
So either I have it on my computer hard drive and an external hard drive, or if I'm only going to store it on an external hard drive, it's an external hard drive that's rated, that's two drives, it creates two copies of the data. In case one drive in that series goes bad, I have them both.
So what you guys are saying also, it sounds like it's probably best to really be careful with these drives.
Yeah.
Like we used to in the old days.
Yeah, you should definitely not bounce it around if you can help it, and keep it in a climate control, you know, make sure you're protecting the temperatures. But I will say that the majority of the failures I've seen on the external hard drives has tended to be with the case and not with the drive itself. The drive itself tends to hold up, but the plastic and the soldering on the little circuit board they put inside the case that allows the drive to interface with the USB cable, that goes bad more often than not. Same thing with thumb drives. The solid-state part of the drive stays good, but the electronics are weak. So what allows your system to interface with the data goes bad. And if you replace that, and it's hard to do on a thumb drive, but it's easy to do on an external hard drive because it's just a hard drive in there.
Yeah.
So you pull that drive out, you put it into a new enclosure, you get a new cable, and a lot of times you can start to get your data, although in your situation it's not sounding that way. But if it's worth a shot if you cannot get your files off of there.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I bought one of those USB to multiple different kinds of hard drive ports.
Yeah.
I was going to try that on it.
Yeah, that's a good thing to try.
Okay, I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, thanks for your call. Bye-bye.
I like the standard drives if I'm going to have something and just have it sit on a desk, but I kind of like the idea of getting like the solid-state drives if I'm going to have something that's going to go in a backpack and make the rounds with me and, you know. Although, arguably, thumb drives, you can get 64-gig thumb drives. That's almost enough just if you're looking for, like, large amounts of data to travel with you.
Well, if any data that I have that's going to travel with me is still going to live somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
I have an other copy of it, because if I lose the drive, I mean, even if it doesn't fail.
Oh, yeah, you could. Oops. You know, ruin my backpack.
I will say this on the last trip, I was carrying all these electronics. I was carrying my iPhone. We had the iPad. I had the GPS. I had the mobile Wi-Fi hotspot. I had the GoPro camera. I had all this stuff plugged in and carrying around my laptop, carrying around all my camera gear, all my battery chargers, and keeping track of what we use called the bits and bobs. It's all about the bits and bobs. So this, I lost one thing, and it was a lightning cable for an iPhone. And I found an internet cafe that had cables, but they're cheap Chinese cables. But I was pretty happy that I only lost one piece of technology, and it was just a cable. But if I was carrying around thumb drives, I would lose those. I run a real risk of losing small things like that. So if I'm carrying stuff around on a thumb drive, I will always have a copy on my home system somewhere. All right, Groovehouse.
Yes.
Who do we have up next?
Up next, we're going to speak with Gary.
Hi, Gary. You're on the air.
Hi, guys. It's a little slow tonight, so I thought that Jay might like to hear a good Irish joke.
All right, as long as it's not too offensive.
Well, Mr. Murphy and his wife are drinking at the pub, and they left, and they're driving home. And Murphy looks in his rearview mirror, and there's the flashing lights. So he pulls over, and the policeman comes up and says, "Mr. Murphy, do you realize that your wife just fell out of the car two blocks back?" Murphy says, "Oh, thank God, I thought I'd gone deaf." Good night.
Good night.
You want to hear another?
I think one's enough.
All right, good night.
Appreciate it. That was a good one. I was just, you know, go out on a high note. That was a good one.
Ireland.
Those Irish, wacky Irish. All right, 713-526-5738. I see a call coming in. 713-526-KPFT. Groovehouse, who do we have up next?
Up next, we're going to speak with Mac.
Mac, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hey, what's going on, you guys?
Hey, not much.
Hey, my question was similar to the gentleman before. I have a Western Digital My Studio and a Western Digital My Book.
Uh-huh.
So My Studio I had owned for like maybe 3 months, and it's gone bad. I took it to Best Buy. Paid the $100, they said they couldn't do anything about it. I was wondering, what do I do in order to get that data? Because it was data from my photography business, and it's all, I learned the hard way that I need to do backups of a backup.
Right, so when you took it to Best Buy and paid them $100, what effort, do you know what they did to try to recover the data?
They took it out of the case and tried to run it, you know, straight.
All right, that's exactly what I would have done. And if they did that and they still could not access the data, then what you have is an actual failed hard drive. So either your reader arms are bad, or you got a bad platter, or something inside the mechanics of the drive has gone bad. Now, the good news is that your data is probably still there and intact and on those platters that are inside that drive. The bad news is that the kind of work that's required to recover that data is very expensive.
That's what I thought.
Because they can take that drive and disassemble it and put those platters into a new set of mechanics and read the data right off of it.
Okay.
So, but depending on, like I've seen back, the last time I had to do it was something like that was a laptop hard drive that was probably only about 80 gigs. And it was around $1,200 to $1,500 to get the data off of. But we got everything.
Okay.
So if the data is important to you, you can start with a company. I first of all, would probably never have paid Best Buy $100 to do that. They did it right, but it was not worth $100. That's
right.
But because you could have done that for a $20 cable, you could have done that yourself. You could have cracked that case open, pulled that drive out, plugged it into a cable, stuck it into a USB port on your computer and seen whether or not you could read the data. What I would do is I would look for a company. The company that I've used, and they're probably one of the most well-known and best data recovery companies around, is OnTrack, and they might go by a different name these days, but O-N-T-R-A-C-K. Let me just do that real quick.
Okay.
And you can, data recovery. They're called Kroll OnTrack now, K-R-O. If you just Google search OnTrack, you'll find them, but they're the data recovery specialists. They're the ones that come up and all. I've used them at my company a number of times. You can call them and they can tell you what it costs to get a diagnostic. I think it's a few $100 to get the diagnosis done, but they'll tell you that they whether or not they can get the data or not, and then they'll tell you how much it's going to cost to retrieve it.
Okay, cool.
If it was me and it was my photos, I'd probably have to just bite the bullet and do it though.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm thinking. And you were saying to do a RAID?
What I've done for my backup solution right now is that I buy these drives that they market a certain kind of hard drive, external hard drive, as like the one I have. I can't remember. It's from Simpletech is the one that I have, but there's some different brands. What they do is they put two hard drives in a single case. And so, like one of the ones I have is it's 2 1-terabyte drives. Now, there's a switch. I can use it as a 2-terabyte backup, but I only get one copy of everything. Or I can flip the switch and use it as a 1-terabyte RAID 0, and that gives me 2 hard drives. Each one has a copy of the file.
Right.
Okay. So every time I copy a file from my desktop onto this drive, it's copying it really on the two drives. So I have 1 terabyte of storage, but it's redundant.
Right.
And that's what I recommend. Either that or a NAS RAID server where you can have multiple drives. But I would definitely look into one of those. They're not cheap. Like you go out and you buy an external hard drive, they tend to be relatively inexpensive. But when you start to buy these, they can be a couple $100.
But I spent good money on the other one, and it failed pretty quick. My other question, would you work directly from that hard drive, or because I have like a 500 gig hard drive on my computer, and I had transferred my whole system over to that to work from. But that was the reason why.
My workflow for dealing with my photographs goes like this: I take the photos off my camera and throw them onto my desktop computer. I do all my edits and I do all my work on that, and then I take that once I'm done with it. And then I'm taking a risk because I don't automatically back it up. What I do is I take it off the camera, put it onto my computer, and then I go to town and I edit and I get everything I want. And then I publish what I want, or I send off the work to the client or whatever. Right. Then I take that whole folder and I dump it over onto the external hard drive for storage. If I need to go back and work on it, I could work on it directly on the drive. But what I typically tend to do is I go find the folder with those images from that photo shoot, drag it back to my desktop because it's just, spend the time to copy it back, and then I work on it or get what I need. Unless I'm just going to grab a file or something. But if I'm going to go back to town into Lightroom and open up the catalog again, I'll bring that back over to the main hard drive so I'm not doing it over the USB or the FireWire.
Right. Because it was working fine for me working.
You can do it that way, and sometimes it's fine. I mean, it's just some of my image catalogs are like 700 raw files.
Right.
Each one's 25 megs a piece, so it gets a little kind of sluggish when you're doing that.
Okay.
But you can work directly on the hard drive, or you can copy it back over to the system. These days I don't tend to go back that often into the old archives, but every once in a while I want to bring back a shoot, and I want to go back through and see if I missed something or if I could do something a little better with new techniques I've learned. And so I just drag the whole folder back. And it might take a little while to copy, but I just let it do that. And then because once I've decided to go back into an old catalog and work on it again, I've kind of already predetermined that I'm going to be spending some time with it. So let's bring it back to the computer and work on it. And then I'll put my changes back.
Okay. Okay. Well, I greatly appreciate that information.
All right, well, good luck. I hope you get your images back.
Yeah, thanks.
All right, bye-bye. All right.
So if something, I was going to say, if something's really important to you, you probably should copy it in multiple locations, like physically different systems. Because even if you have, you know, an enclosure that's got two mirrored drives or even RAID 5 or even mirrored RAID 5s, that's great. You know, if a disk fails, you can replace it. You don't lose data. Or if one of the RAID sides fails, it's okay. You've got a backup RAID copy on the other side of mirrored RAID 5s or whatever. The problem is, if your RAID controller fails while it's writing data, it will write garbage onto everything.
Right.
And then even though you had mirrored disks or you had mirrored RAID 5s or whatever, that garbage is spewed across all of it. So, you know, it's only if the drive goes bad.
No, but if the controller goes bad and you write bad data.
And that's not that common, but I have had it happen at a place I worked.
Knock
wasn't
wood,
pretty.
It has not happened, and, you know, I agree. And there are times that I think, well, rather than doing a RAID, I should have two external hard drives on a hub, and I should just copy it twice. But the fact that if you're backing up at all, good for you. You know, because a lot of people just don't. They just don't. And backing up does not mean, and in my mind, it does not mean just putting it on an external hard drive and then deleting it off your main drive, because that's still...
Because you don't have two copies at that point.
You want to have two copies of it.
And physically separate types of devices.
And, you know, if you want to go a step further, you should make two copies, and then you should rotate one of those copies off-site. So in case your house gets blown up by terrorists that the NSA was unable to stop.
Or you can also, which just takes more work, you can also burn stuff to CD or DVD, which gives you a physical copy that lasts at least 10 years.
Yeah, but, you know, God, 10 years is going to come. I don't believe it'll last 10 years, and 10 years is going to come and go. And
Because regular, like, ROM CDs are supposed to last up to 20 years in good condition.
They're different grades, too. I know they're, like, gold and silver grades. Some will go up, like, 25 years for archives and stuff. But I don't even know if that's marked anymore. I wouldn't know where to go to find it.
Well, I will tell you one thing that you might want to consider, too, if you're a photographer especially, and although it's not an easy place to manage getting your files back, because they don't catalog them in logical ways to get the file names. But I put my better photos on Flickr, and I tag them, and that I can always go find them there. I've actually gone to my Flickr account numerous times and pulled files from there that if I need to have a print done or somebody wants to buy. And it's also a good way to show off your work, but a terabyte of storage.
And hopefully they're too big to have a massive failure.
I heard they back up to floppy every night, so it's cool.
Because that's gotten less common. That happens less common. But 10 years ago, you know, it wasn't horribly uncommon, you know, for people to like, oh, yeah, I've got this free email. Did it happen to Hotmail? I don't remember what happened. There were some where it's like, oh, I've got this free email. Oh, and they just lost, like, you know, 15% of their users lost all their email, and it's not recoverable. I don't remember who that's happened to, but that used to happen. It seems like it's happening a lot less nowadays than it used to.
A lot of these larger companies that do this kind of work, they have a lot of redundancy in place. I mean, I know Flickr at one point a couple of years ago deleted somebody's photos, but they were able to get them back. So 713-526-5738 if you want to be on the air with us tonight. 713-526-KPFT. We got about 20 minutes left in the show, but we've got time to take calls. I see we have three calls in the queue. Groovehouse is going to line them up and serve them to us. So who's first?
All right, first volley, we're going to have Syed.
Syed, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hi, gentlemen. Thank you. Problem I'm having, well, I think I'm having at work, you know, you get that little amber house-looking alert at the bottom saying, you know, Microsoft Security Essentials. Now, I remember that being a virus, so I don't click on it. I don't know what to do with it, but I thought, okay, maybe this will cause a problem for me. So on, you know, I managed to download whatever I was supposed to and run malware and what have you, and it's still there. So I don't know whether it's legit or not.
Do you have Microsoft Security Essentials installed on your computer?
Well, I don't know. I don't know whether somebody installed it or not. The real thing. I mean, it is it's an actual program, right? Correct. But I understand there is a virus that mimics that, or you can click on it and it has the same name on it.
There is a virus that mimics that. But there is also the real Microsoft Security Essentials. So
if how would I know?
Well, one thing you could try to do. I mean, what you've got the alert. If you've got if it's a virus or spyware, and it's popping up on your computer, you're infected. So, if you click on it or you don't click on it. You know, if you've shut down all your open applications, you shut down your web browser, shut down your email, and you're getting a little red alert that says Microsoft Security Essentials, either it's you're infected and that's the virus talking to you, or it's actually Microsoft Security Essentials. You're going to need to open it up and have a look. If it's not a pop up from a website, the way it gets on your computer in the first place, these fake ones, is that a fake alert pops up in a window, but it's web-related. And you click it, and that's when you infect yourself. But if this is popping up and you don't have a web browser open, then chances are you're already infected, or it really is Microsoft Security Essentials.
Well, this is the thing. It doesn't actually pop up. All it says is, you know, you may be unprotected. And it just happens when even you reboot the computer, it'll come up and, you know, it'll say,
do you have an antivirus program installed on your computer?
Not one that runs all the time.
Then Microsoft has a setting that will tell you, you may not be protected if you have it turned off. Microsoft is designed to do that. Microsoft Windows is designed to say, you're at risk. We don't see that you have a virus scanner, an antivirus program running, so you get that little alert. It's a little red shield with a white X in it.
Well, that's the thing. It's not. That's not what it is. And that one I'm used to seeing. This is a little house-looking amber-colored thing. Looks like a fortress, I guess. I don't know. But
that's Microsoft Security Essentials icon.
Okay. Is there something inside, somewhere internally that I can check instead of just relying on this icon to tell me anything? I mean, can I go into my computer somewhere or you know, the firewall, or is there anything else that I could check to confirm whether this is a real thing or not? See, the reason why I'm also suspicious, okay, that one computer, I ran malware on it and it was fine. It didn't pick up anything. It picked up some other stuff, but that's still there. Okay. Well, I tried to do the same on another computer and it won't allow me to run anything. Even if it allows me to download something.
Because it's infected. Because it's infected. There is a virus. Okay. There are a number of viruses out there that prevent you from running antivirus programs or anti-spyware programs on the system.
That's what I figured. Anything with an EXE, it says, do you want to open? And then it, of course, gives you that choice. What do you want to open it with? Well, I don't want to open it with anything. I want to run it.
Yes. So, how do I get rid of
the best way to get rid of that?
Let me speak. All right. First of all, now that you brought up a second computer with a second problem, the one that won't run EXEs may be clean of viruses, but it's changed how EXEs are run. So there's a way to restore the ability to run EXE files. EXE file. Let's see, association.
Would a system restore help?
It might, but there's a fix for the EXE broken EXE association. I won't be able to solve it on the air. You can email me with that one. But the other one, You can look in add remove programs to see if Microsoft Security Essentials is installed.
Okay.
If it is, then chances are it's legit. If you still don't believe that it's legit, you can uninstall Microsoft Security Essentials and see if the alert goes away. If it does, then you know it was legit, and then you can reinstall Microsoft Security Essentials and update it. Now, programs like Microsoft Security Essentials do need to be updated. and they will squawk at you. They will say, look, I'm not up to date. You need to update me. Update me, you lazy SOB. Now, so you have to respond to that. You have to figure out whether that's legit or not. Based on what you're telling me, it's either legit or you're already infected. If you've scanned with other tools and they haven't detected anything, then it's probably legit. But if you scanned with other tools and they haven't detected anything because they haven't been able to detect it, and you're still infected, you're still going to have to deal with it. So open that up, find out.
So if I check on the, you know, the chain add or
add remove,
you know,
remove programs.
Yeah, add remove, and if I don't see it listed in there, on there at all,
yeah.
But I'm, obviously I have an icon there.
Yeah.
That tells me that it's most likely malware or virus.
That's correct. What malware tools are you using?
I used Malwarebytes.
Okay.
And I actually also ran AVG, and I used Super Anti-Spyware.
Well, you know, like I said, go look in add remove programs and see if you've got Microsoft Security Essentials. Since you have those other tools, if you do have Microsoft Security Essentials, go ahead and uninstall it. Run your other antiviruses, and if you uninstall Security Essentials and that icon goes away, then you know it was legit, but it doesn't matter because you have the other antivirus tools anyway.
Okay, I'll give it a try.
All right, good luck. Sorry that it's so confusing, but it'll be...
No,
it'll
that's
work.
Fine. You've been helpful. Thank you so
All right,
much.
Thank you. Right. All right, yeah, so there's a virus out there that will basically make it so every time you try to run an .exe file, it'll shut it down, and there's also one that will cause it where it changes the file associations for .exe files. So you double-click on an .exe file and says, well, what do you want me to do? What program should I use to open this with? Well, you are the program
Notepad.
I'm trying to run. But broken .exe associations can be fixed. If you Google search broken .exe association, you'll find some steps on how to restore that functionality inside of various versions of the Windows operating system. I'm so glad to be back and talking about spyware. It's like I never left. All right, Groovehouse.
Digestive.
Yes. Digestive. It is digestive. I can feel it eating my brain. Groovehouse.
Yes.
Who's up next?
Up next, we're going to speak with Derek.
Derek, you're on the air with Technology Bytes.
Yes. Earlier, whenever you were talking about backups and a drive that you had, that you mentioned that you could flip a switch and put it into RAID.
Yeah.
You said zero earlier, and that's striping, right? Not mirroring.
Right. I'm sorry. RAID 1.
RAID 1 is mirroring.
I misspoke.
Okay. That was all.
Okay. Thank you.
My work here is done. I will call everyone on the net and tell them how they were wrong. I'll
drop the mic and walk away.
Yeah.
You're right, RAID 1. You know, I was, until I actually started using RAID drives in the very limited capacity that I use them now, I never liked them. And I don't like internal RAID situations still with dedicated RAID controllers. Although I know in the external hard drive, that's kind of a dedicated RAID controller. But by running RAID 1 means that I could take that drive out and just use it as a drive because it's not striped.
Right, yeah.
So striped RAIDs are the ones that intimidate me. So RAID 0 is the one that I don't like. RAID 1 I like. RAID 5, I don't even know what that is.
But then you get like RAID 10, RAID 0 plus 1. RAID 50.
RAID 5 is block level parity with striping.
Using SCSI drives.
It's because instead of having a dedicated parity drive, the parity drive is also striped across all the drives.
I have a parity drive. It takes all of my files and turns them into animated GIFs. So how many RAID drives do you have?
Personally?
Yeah.
None.
Okay. Groovehouse, what about you?
That's not really. I don't have any. I've got a backup system that will write to two things,
to
but
two
it's
drives?
Not a RAID system.
Okay.
It's
so you're just using
it's
two
a backup
separate.
Software that just does it on its own.
Now, somebody asked me, you found a backup software that will write out to two different drives?
Save all my photos on one drive, and then the backup system backs up that drive.
Oh, but it's not taking everything off your one hard drive and writing it out to two different drives.
Groovehouse for photos.
Yeah.
I got you.
No, it's a homemade backup system.
That's cool. I was just wondering, the software came with the external. I know, but somebody was asking me if there was a backup software that would take the data on the primary drive and actually write it out to two different external drives.
Hmm. Intern.
I would just use rsync.
Rsync?
Yeah, you could do it that way, yeah.
I use rsync to do stuff like that.
Is that another one of those Irish terms?
Rsync.
Rsync backup.
Rsync and lace.
Rsync backup, your sync not so much. Do we have time? Maybe, maybe not. 713-526-5738. 713-526-KPFT. We got...
I thought you meant, do we have time to continue this? And I was going to say no.
No, we don't. No, I mean, if we have more calls. I can see we got a call in the queue, so we're going to take that call in a second. But about 11 minutes, so minus the four to go out, that's still about 7 minutes. So we'll see. We'll take this call. If you want to be on the air, we may or may not be able to get some more calls on the air. 713-526-5738. Groovehouse?
Yes.
One call coming in. Who do you have for us?
Up next, we've got Adam.
Adam, you're on the air with Technology Bytes.
Hi, guys. I was wondering what your take on the SteamOS Wiz, the new operating system released by Valve.
I think it's a good way to go. I think what they're trying to do is get rid of the operating systems to where, you know, like on one DVD you can, you know, boot into something, it just play, it go. I think it's going to be good for Linux in general because it means a lot of, like, you know, good, solid quality, maybe not open source, maybe closed binaries, but the graphics drivers are coming out, their hardware acceleration is coming out, and it should be kind of cool to see what they do, because I think they're gunning for, you know, you've got like the new Xbox coming out, Sony PlayStations, everyone's kind of gunning to be like that living room, you know, I don't want to say set top box, but you know, like,
I guess that's the one that everybody's gaming on, right?
It's the one that's gaming, but they also want to do like streaming movies, and you know, just have it kind of be the end all be all of entertainment. So I think more competition's better, and, you know, I used to try to be a Linux gamer, and it got kind of hard for a while, and maybe this will kind of bring it back.
I'm probably going to cobble together some pieces from around the house, because I'm kind of like the local tech guy for family and friends.
Yeah.
So I have enough spare hardware. I'm probably going to build a – I was thinking about building a Linux box anyway, but so now I'm going to build a Steam box.
Yeah, I think it's worthwhile. I mean, back in the days, you know, when, for instance, like, you know, Quake Theory Arena – and a lot of that, you could actually run your own Quake servers on Linux. You know, like Windows servers could hold maybe 10 or 15 players. You put on like even a slow Linux box and you could host 20 players, you know, almost all at the same time. And that's what I miss. You know, it's kind of cool that, you know, you've got Steam, and if you want to play like with other players, you kind of have to go to their service. But maybe with this stuff, I'm hoping that there'll be some hacks or some mods or some patches that will let people kind of take gaming back and, you know, throw their own network games if they want to. So, we'll see. We'll see how open it is, or, you know, if they choose to just lock everything down. But I think it's good for Linux, and it's probably good for gaming.
Cool. I was also wondering if you think anybody besides gamers really build their own PCs. Cause Have you seen anybody else besides gamers? Maybe just my circle of friends might be.
Well, I think gamers have definitely been the ones that want to push the overclocking and specking out
hardware.
They
push stuff the hardest. They're definitely the ones that brought lights into computers and all the cool case mods, if you want to, you know, whatever.
I think gamers are probably the biggest push for it, but I don't think they're the only ones who do it, though.
You still have geeks, you've got a lot of penny pinchers, all kinds of different graphics.
Musicians do it, video editors do it, you know, people that need a lot of horsepower and want to get the most bang for their buck, that need, you know, they need the horsepower, they need the computer to run as lean and as good as and fast as possible. They'll buy the faster drives, they'll buy the faster processors, they'll build it with more RAM, that sort of thing. All right?
All right, well, thank you. Before I go, look up Cobian for double backups. They it's great for setting scripts for backing up things to multiple locations.
All right. With a C or with a K?
C or K for Cobian?
C-O-B-I-A-N.
Okay, thanks.
Appreciate
it. Bye. All right. Groovehouse.
Yes.
Who's up?
Up next, we are going to speak with Andres.
Hello?
Andres, you're on the air.
Hi, guys. I'm a great fan of yours. I just have a quick question. I recently had a 1.5 terabyte drive fail, and it's kind of unlike any of the other external hard drives that I've had in that it's a Seagate that has the eSATA port that is a detachable. So it's got the tail with the USB cord that you can detach from the hard drive, and that part, the detachable part, works fine with other hard drives when I put them in. But since you guys said that sometimes it's the enclosure that doesn't work and not the hard drive, I was wondering if maybe if I still take the plastic casing off, it might still be just the hard drive, because I've been scared to take the plastic off the actual hard drive.
No, yeah, what I'm talking about is now you're talking about the cable, the you have a USB to eSATA cable. Is that what you're saying?
It's an external hard drive that has that built in.
Okay, so that part there that it converts from the SATA to the USB is it's not actually the hard drive. It's a case that's on the hard drive, right?
I'm sorry?
I'm trying to understand the mechanics of the drive. Okay, I can buy a hard drive. It could be IDE or it could be SATA, right?
It's a SATA drive.
Now, I understand that. Now, I can buy the drive, and then I can buy an enclosure that will allow me to put that drive in the enclosure and then connect it to my USB port.
Mm-hmm.
That enclosure can be replaced.
Right.
So are you saying that the cable that comes out of your computer and connects to your external hard drive, does it plug into the drive directly, or does it plug into the case of the drive?
It looks like it plugs into the drive. It looks like any other eSATA.
Okay, so it looks like it's going straight into the eSATA. So, no, that kind of replacement, you're talking about replacing a part of the drive, and that probably won't work, or that's going to be a dicier proposition. I would leave that to a professional.
Okay, so I should just send it to Seagate, even though the actual cable works? Because it doesn't sound like a normal click of death. The LED blinks.
The SATA drive does not have an LED on it, so that's a case.
Right, right. It's the part of the cable. It's like another piece of the case that attaches to the USB cord, and that has the SATA port on the other end.
Right. That may be what's bad. That could be removed, and you could try taking this and putting it into another eSATA adapter. And try to connect to the drive directly.
Okay, even though when I use that cable with other drives and they work,
it's not the cable, right? It's the you have a cable, you have a case that has the drive in it, and you have the drive, right? So the drive connects to the case converts the SATA to USB, and that cable is the cable itself. Is it SATA on one side and USB on the other?
Yes, and it's like another part that looks like it's part of the case when it came with it, but you can actually detach it, and it's the female and the male of the SATA.
See, I'm not really clear on what you have there, but it sounds to me like you have the drive connecting to an interface, and the interface connects to the cable, and the cable connects to the computer.
Yes, exactly, and the interface works with other drives, but the drive, when I hook it back just like it came, it's giving me like a beep and like a blinking LED.
But see, I don't recall any hard drive having an LED light on it.
Right, it's the actual it's the part that's attached to the USB cable.
Okay, but you could take that part and connect it to another drive and it doesn't beep.
Right, and then the drives work fine.
Okay. I got you. So, yeah, it sounds like you've pulled it out. Yeah, it could be that the drive itself has failed, so I wouldn't take the drive itself apart.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for your call. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Yeah, one time I had a drive that had a failed circuit board. I had actually burned on the board, and I bought another drive just like it, and I swapped the board. But that was a little bit more. I wouldn't recommend that necessarily, because you could play, if you don't get the exact match, you could blow it up. Even worse. All right, well, we're out of time, so we're going to get out of here. You've been listening to Technology Bites, you lucky devils. We have some flash of phone calls there, but they're all gone now. So
we ran out of time.
Yeah, we did.
It's hard to judge if we can take calls.
Tune in next week for more Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Plicted.
I'm Barrett.
And he's
Groove House.
Give me hair. Thank you.
KPFT's Irish Airs host a fundraiser at Dan Electro's Guitar Bar on Sunday, September 29th. Great music and dance. Free food and loads of people to chat with. Doors open at 12:30 and performers include The Blackguards, The Traveling Murphys, Constant Billy, Dead Rabbits, and more. Proceeds benefit KPFT. The event happens September 29th at Dan Electro's Guitar Bar, 1031 East 24th Street. This is KPFT Houston. Join KPFT on Sunday, October 6th, as we celebrate Night Sounds, heard Friday overnights on KPFT. The benefit concert supports your community radio station. Featured music includes Bateman Red, Charity Ann, First Trip, The Hightailers, The Roosevelt House Band, and more. The show happens October 6th from 3 to 9 p.m. at The Last Concert Cafe, 1403 Nance Street. Visit us at facebook.com/KPFT Houston.